Why are we so over-policed?
When you have a society divided as ours is, according to white supremacy and racial privilege, and which reflects a powerful racial fear as a result, the wealthy and the whitest, will demand police to keep them safe, according to this insecurity that they feel. And this is why we live in this kind of society. It was not natural. It was created, and it was created to uphold those inequalities.
That's Gio Mayer. We talk with him about his new book, A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. It's out from Verso Books. Then we hear the thrilling and hopeful story of a rural community that took on a global gold mining corporation and won. John Cavanna and Robin Broad tell us about their book, The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When the world erupted in global protests against police violence in the wake of George Floyd's murder in 2020, it seemed like finally some real police reform was possible. Calls came to defund the police, even abolish policing, in favor of tackling the roots of crime with social supports. But a year later, even the most minimal reform, ending the so-called qualified immunity that puts police above the law, has been ignored. Police departments are more flush with funds than ever before. Against a step backward, radical political theorist Gio Mayer has written a guide for the way forward to real police reform. In his book, A World Without Police, he brilliantly diagnoses the problem of policing in our society and shows how communities can become safer, stronger, and more democratic by creating beneficial alternatives to policing. Gio Mayer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
This book, A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete, starts with the siege of the Minneapolis 3rd Police Precinct. You say that siege, which was after the murder of George Floyd, was an act of collective mourning and a celebration. Why do you begin the book there?
I think especially now, a year on, we should be perfectly clear on the momentous nature of the rebellion that broke out last year in response to the murder, not only of George Floyd, but also of Breonna Taylor, of Ahmaud Arbery, and of a general building sense that's been building, honestly, for years, that there's a crisis of policing that needs to be addressed in radical ways. The bravery and the resistance shown in the streets of Minneapolis and the sustained nature of that resistance spread across the country. And it's easy to forget a year on just how radical the demands were at the time, just how widespread resistance was. We're talking about an international movement for radical transformation of the police and of public safety. And I think we should give all credit to, where credit is due. In other words, to those on the streets in Minneapolis. The crystallization of that resistance around the third precinct was even more profound still, right? Here was a police precinct that was taken over by protesters, that was burned. And on top of that, the majority of Americans polled at the time understood perfectly well why it was happening and supported it and said that it was a legitimate act in that moment in response to the sort of collective frustration over Floyd's death.
Yes, and you say that it gave us a glimpse of an other world entirely, as your comments just now indicate. But I have to say, it seems like January 6th, the backlash to that was the world that replaced it. What's your sense of that?
I think, I think I'm a little more optimistic in the sense that, the resistance that we're seeing today has been growing for well over a decade at this point. understood globally, it's been growing for several decades. Resistance to global social inequalities, neoliberal capitalism, and resistance to white supremacy, colonialism, and policing has been growing. And, you know, the tide has been rising for many years. I think the Trump years were in many ways a reaction to this, certainly a backlash, a reaction to even the tepid language of equality that surfaced around, you know, the presidency of Barack Obama, during which we should remember Black Lives Matter and mass resistance in Ferguson and Baltimore were, you know, the essence of, you know, of the transformations that, that, you know, that people were beginning to set into motion during those years. In other words, it came from the streets at that time as well. You know, so I think the Trump years, and I think building up to what we saw on January 6th was a backlash against these demands. And this is something we see throughout US history. We always see backlash to demands for Black freedom in particular. And my hope, you know, and my optimism, I think, is grounded in the fact that there, you know, there's more of us than there are of them, that this is a last dying gasp of a reactionary white world that, you know, has lost all contact with reality.
That's for sure. So the Minneapolis City Council also at that time, around that time, vowed to abolish the police department, and yet that was stymied. So I want to say I share your hope, but I also want to ask some hard questions about what resulted, particularly in Minneapolis.
Absolutely. You know, the nuts and bolts of it, we're looking at a very sort of unprecedented move by city council. I think there were people on the ground that were skeptical of their will even at that moment. But it wasn't city council that actually stalled the project. It was this sort of strange unelected charter commission that stepped in and attempted to stop you know, this process of dismantling. Because like so many other cities, and this is something that people may find surprising, there are a variety of legal protections preventing any action against the police. In other words, preventing democratic intervention to control police power. What this looked like in Minneapolis was a, you know, in the city charter, a specification of how many police officers were required per, you know, by population. And this was something that had to be changed for the dismantling to move forward. And that's where it had stalled, you know, at that point. At the same time, again, we're talking about an utterly unprecedented move by city council, something that reflected demands from below, demands from grassroots movements. And the question today is pushing that horizon, continuing to build, continuing to develop those alternatives.
Yes, and that's very much where your book is going. But first, it really is a brilliant deconstruction of policing in America as an institution, historically and currently. In fact, you say we live in a world of police. We live in a society that is built around policing. What do you mean by that?
When I say a world of police, I mean just that. I mean a society that is built around not just the institution of the police, but the idea that policing is the solution to all problems, right? Social inequality, send the police. Mental health crisis, send the police. Lack of after-school activities for teenagers, send in the police and make sure that they're under control. And policing is, you know, really a one-size-fits-all solution, but the only tool that the police bring to a given situation is force, is violence. And so it should be no surprise that this expansion of police into broader territories of social life, into schools, into, you know, in libraries, into neighborhoods even more, creates more violence, creates more brutality, and doesn't lead toward the solutions that many hold out, these sort of mythical solutions of, you know, reforming the police, of making them better. And this is in part because we need to be absolutely clear on the fact that the police were not designed, they were not created, they were not invented to keep the public at large safe. They were created to protect, police, and patrol privilege. They're the guardians of social inequality, right? Where when you've got a society vastly divided between haves and have-nots, the poorest and the richest, the rich will have police to defend their property. When you have a society divided as ours is according to white supremacy and racial privilege, and which reflects a powerful racial fear as a result, the wealthy and the whitest, you know, will demand police to keep them safe according to this insecurity that they feel. And this is why we live in this kind of society. It was not natural. It was created, and it was created to uphold those inequalities. When we talk about abolishing the police, we're talking about a long process of undoing those inequalities, of dismantling white supremacy and capitalism, and building a very different kind of society in which community self-determination makes the police unnecessary.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Geo Mayer about his book, A World Without Police. Yeah, and talk more about that, because, you know, this book very much zeroes in on the role of the police in suppressing communities of color, but you never forget the larger context of capitalism, something I think people are beginning to call racial capitalism. Talk about, you know, some of the history of how this developed in this country, the twin mission of the police to protect capitalism and racial inequality.
Sure. Capitalism and racism and white supremacy and colonialism have always gone hand in hand. They've always worked together. Race has always aided and been used as a weapon for capital accumulation. And this is especially sharp in the history of the United States, where the institution of chattel slavery hardened that racial opposition even more than in many other regions, and left a powerful legacy that outlasted, of course, slavery itself. So from the very origins of the police, you had largely in the North, police policing, property, wealth, and attempting to control sort of undesirable or unruly immigrant classes. And in the South, you had police growing directly out of slave patrols. In other words, those sort of quasi-vigilantes who were empowered to enforce, white supremacist legal and political domination. Of course, that was about economics as well. At every point, this is about both race and economics. It's about ensuring a docile, weak labor force that can be controlled and corralled. At the same time, that it's about, and all often emerges in response to, the kind of racialized fear of people of color that we see so often behind these sort of panics that generate heightening waves of mass incarceration and repressive policing.
And one of the interesting threads that you follow in the book is how, the police, the ranks of the police are drawn from the white working class originally, and now more and more, it's multiracial as well, which I will get back to. But, for example, the creation of police unions, talk about that and talk about how the police are really not the same. Let's say the police as workers are not, you say, in fact, they're not workers, that they're a gang. They're violence workers, if anything.
Absolutely. So, I mean, if you understand, U.S. history, according to the way that, for example, W.E.B. Du Bois and his sort of magisterial Black Reconstruction describes it, it's out of the ashes of slavery that the police are born, to continue to control, to continue to enforce this power. And it's precisely the police that embody this betrayal by poor whites, who should, by all rights, according to Du Bois, unify with other poor people, poor, Black former slaves, and resist the wealthy, but they do not. They volunteer to enforce power and white privilege and control and capitalist domination by joining the police. That's very much the case today. Police are not workers. They are organized strike breakers. And yet they call themselves unionized workers. They claim a place within union federations like the AFL-CIO. And one of the primary arguments of this book is that we need to, when we're talking about abolition, we're not simply talking about dismantling the police forces. We're talking about identifying the root of police power, the institutions that uphold it, and attacking those institutions. And police unions are at the very center of that. They negotiate absolutely scandalous local contracts, binding contracts with city governments that make it almost impossible to hold them accountable. And you can go through some of these contracts and see the rules. And I think many people would be astonished at the fact that not only is it the case that you have these special violence workers who are given the power to act violently on behalf of the state, not only are they not held to a higher standard, which would make sense, they're held to a far lower standard. And they're, you know, and they operate with what is essentially unbridled impunity. Many of these conditions require that, for example, any investigation of police misconduct has to start very quickly, or it, you know, or immediately expires. And misconduct allegations and findings in investigations are essentially wiped off the books in many cities after a period from months to a couple of years, which just leads to this dynamic of abusive police, you know, essentially operating as if they have no, you know, no record and no disciplinary record at all because of the way that they've written these contracts. And so they work impunity at the into the very center of these negotiations. And this is amplified even more on the state level, where police, you know, organizations negotiate and press and push through special legislation, what are called Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, which give police special due process, you know, which make them a special class of citizens above and beyond other citizens, and make it even harder again legally to even begin to transform, society. You know, these things are upheld in laws and in on municipal levels, and this is part of the dismantling that we need to engage in: is rolling back this power, eliminating these police unions, and, you know, expelling them from the broader union federations, insisting that there's no place for murderous police organizations within unions, and beginning the process of really annihilating those unions entirely. No other sector of the working class claims the right with impunity to kill other workers, and yet that's exactly what police do every day.
And yet how can we, I mean, as you point out in this book, Geomar, in the book A World Without Police, the power of the unions is so great that the deck is stacked against being able to rein them in. What is an entry point that can be taken that actually we can realistically do?
I mean, I think what's very interesting about the last year is that you do see these police organizations, the Fraternal Order of Police, the benevolent associations, you know, elsewhere, you see them on the defensive. And it's in part because they betray their own sort of worst, you know, beliefs and demands. They, in their sort of resentful, you know, statements to the press, you know, in their appearances on Fox News, reveal themselves to be utterly fascistic, reveal themselves to be, you know, absolutely committed to resisting any oversight, any civilian, you know, control, and insisting on it in what is a total impunity. And it's as a result of that, and especially in the context of the mass resistance of the past year, that suddenly these unions and these, you know, these so-called unions are finding doors shut to them. They're finding less, you know, ability to leverage and essentially force city administrations to do what is their will. We need to keep the pressure up on them. Again, starting within unions is a good start, expelling them from the unions and isolating them. And then being able to understand and making clear exactly what kind of a role they have, rolling back this legislation. The good thing about police power, though, and it's kind of ironic, it's a paradox of the centrality and the power that policing has had in US history, is that even small changes generate these lasting, you know, chain reactions and can create much broader changes, in part because of the reaction, in part because when people rise up in Minneapolis and demand an end to police murder, the police respond as if they're mortally at risk. You know, they respond to tiny demands with the most, you know, panicked and reactionary, you know, reaction.
And just a little note about Minneapolis, we all watched the trial of Derek Chauvin, in which the Minneapolis Police Department appeared to play a fairly heroic and anomalous role. What's your interpretation? What's your take on that trial?
I think police trials are very complicated. On the one hand, quite rightly, people in the streets are demanding that police be held accountable. They're demanding an end to impunity. And I think the one good thing you can say about the trial is that, is that police are certainly on the defensive. We know that in particular because so many of Chauvin's counterparts sold him out and testified against him. But we also have to understand that at the very same time, this is because they're trying to save the system. And the constant refrain of the trial was, this is not, you know, policing is not on trial. One officer, three officers are on trial. And that is a desperate reaction by the policing apparatus. The Minneapolis Police Department that sold Derek Chauvin out has been systematically abusive, has used chokeholds, has put people unconscious, has forcibly tranquilized people in custody, has refused all attempts at city oversight. When the Minneapolis city leaders just a few years back attempted to shift some of the funding from the police toward other toward other programs, people who called 911, business owners would call 911 and the police would tell them, don't call us, call your city leaders. And this is how policing works. It's organized blackmail. And we shouldn't allow them to sort of sanitize that image, because that's not how it's been functioning.
And there have been calls for qualified immunity. There's the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which seems to be going nowhere as well as, along with all the rest of the progressive legislation that's been proposed. But I'm not even sure that qualified immunity, an end to qualified immunity, is even in that act anymore.
Right. Of course, I mean, as usual, the Democratic Party is not a very trustworthy vehicle of actual change. And in many ways, it's shameful that the name George Floyd was put on an act that would not have saved George Floyd's life. It's not the kind of radical change we need. And the danger, again, pushing back on police power is good, but the danger is letting, small reforms be a substitute for the more substantial changes that are necessary. The only thing that would have been useful or made a big impact in that bill would have been precisely the qualified immunity piece, which, for those that don't know, is yet another special layer of protection for the police, preventing them from being held accountable and preventing many cases from even being brought against police, for accountability. It's a legal mechanism that could easily, very easily, be written out of the code. And that's the, that's the one main change that had been proposed originally, but the different versions of this law have offered to cut that provision, precisely because Republicans are saying, we will not support an end to qualified immunity, because they know exactly what it means.
Yeah, and which is why we need to end the filibuster. Many have said that reform for the police means to have more policemen of color. And yet you say that even multiracial policing is racist. Why?
Absolutely. I mean, policing is not strictly racist because of who is carrying it out. It's racist because of the function that it performs. Police are sent out there to patrol the poor, and poor people of color in particular. It doesn't matter who's doing that if that's their function. It's the function that's demanded of them. Now, this is borne out. This is not just a hypothesis. This is borne out statistically. When you look at studies of how, for example, officers of color or women, behave on the job, often they're even more racist. Often they are even more aggressive, in part because they are performing this function and need to sort of doubly perform it in order to justify their own status as police officers. So we know from experience that this isn't a solution. This has been part of the proposed reforms for nearly 100 years now, and it's never made a difference.
So now let's talk about what it would look like to abolish the police. A new model for community safety, because you do point out that many of the communities that are over-policed are also under-policed. In other words, the police operate as an occupying force, but not as a protective force.
Of course, again, police for the most part are not, we're not designed to protect. They're designed to enforce domination and uphold inequality. What we know is that, and there's a lot of talk about resistance to defunding or abolishing the police, which draws upon the claim that communities of color, poor communities, are the most vulnerable, and that they simply can't afford to reduce policing numbers because of the danger that exists in those communities. But again, police statistically, historically, incontrovertibly do not make communities safer. Increasing the numbers of police doesn't make communities safer. If anything, the way that communities are policed devastates those communities, throws people into prison. When they come back out, they don't have opportunities. They are, they have a sort of scarlet letter preventing them from even being able to work legally. And so these cycles of instability and danger and social violence, continue. The police don't protect those communities. The point that is true in that question is the fact that what we're seeing is that the police do successfully hollow out all funding that would have been dedicated to actually making communities safer. But we need to understand just how many billions of dollars the police eat up. They do so on the promise that just a little more funding and finally we will have a safe society, when there is no connection between police funding, police staffing numbers, and social safety or public safety. And so we need to understand, and this is where the question of defunding is essential. We need to understand that when we start to take millions of dollars away from the police and invest those into community programs, after school activities, into creating a baseline safety net so that people are not going hungry, so that people are not homeless, our society and our streets will not get more dangerous. And the advantage of defunding is that it will give us a social experiment that allows us to show that to be true, and that allows us to convince those who, of course, for very good reason, assume that we need police because that's what's always been said, but give them an opportunity to see in practice that that's not true.
You also say in this book, Gio Maur, in the book, A World Without Police, that a world without police is a world without capitalism and without white male privilege. Now, I wholly endorse that end, but there's...
Absolutely.
What are the stages in between that can, make communities more livable, more just, even as the capitalist system, I think, which is pretty incontrovertible, is already eroding?
Mm-hmm. As we know from the long history of abolition, from the dismantling of slavery, we know that abolition always goes hand in hand with reconstruction. In other words, with building a different kind of world. And it was precisely historically out of the fact that reconstruction failed after slavery, that so many former slaves were forced back into sharecropping or into what became the system of mass incarceration and convict leasing, because there was no socioeconomic basis for communities to be self-sustaining and stable and safe. We find ourselves living out the long legacy of that. Instead of true freedom from slavery, the United States ended up with the police and prisons. And with what we're coming to recognize, ever more clearly to be a crisis of mass incarceration and hyper-policing. That's the world we need to dismantle at the same time that we are, building an alternative world within the shell of the old, this world without police that already exists, I like to argue. We already know what it looks like. We already look upon family members and friends and neighbors not as antagonists who we need to call the police on at every sign of conflict, but as people that we can talk with and de-escalate conflicts with. There are already hundreds of organizations nationwide, community organizations that de-escalate conflict, that intervene to prevent violence, and they do so far more effectively and at far less human cost than the police. That's what we need to build up, and this goes all the way from the micro level of your neighborhood and your block, getting together with your neighbors, setting up a text chain where everyone can reach out to each other, either if they see the police engaging in misconduct, or if they have an internal community dispute that needs to be de-escalated to prevent the police from being called in. That's the sort of kernel of this new world. And the question is building up from that, stitching together this broader fabric of a world without police, and doing so in conjunction with these moments, like the moment of Minneapolis, which allows for new visions and new horizons to break through into the mainstream.
Well, the book is A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. It is a terrific book. It's a really compelling read. And I want to thank you so much, Gio Maur, for talking with us here about it.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Gio Maur is an organizer, writer, political theorist, and visiting associate professor at Vassar College. A World Without Police is his seventh book. Next up, the thrilling story of a community fighting back against big mining and winning. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In a world dominated by ever more authoritarian corporate power, it's a rare event when ordinary people win. But that's what happened when a small peasant community in El Salvador went up against a global mining corporation that wanted to open a mine that would have poisoned the country's main water source. In their book, The Water Defenders, Robin Broad and John Cavanna tell the inspirational story of how the community overcame seemingly insurmountable odds to win not just one, but two historic victories. The lessons they draw from the story can inspire those who are fighting to defend our communities and the planet against those who put their profits above our survival. Robin Broad and John Cavanna are a husband and wife team who have been involved in the Salvadorian gold mining saga since 2009. Broad is an expert in international development and the recipient of two MacArthur Fellowships. John Cavanna is director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies. Robin Broad and John Cavanna, welcome to Writer's Voice. The Water Defenders tell such an inspiring story, one of the few that one can find where David actually slays Goliath. It's a story about defeating a gold mine. Talk about how mining, especially gold mining, threatens communities with environmental pollution.
Big mines use a huge amount of water, and El Salvador and many other countries face water shortages. Secondly, to separate the gold from the rock, you use cyanide, a toxic chemical. And the mining companies will say, oh, we can control that. They can't. So the toxic cyanide inevitably gets into the water system, poisoning it. And finally, when you mine gold and other minerals and you're smashing up this rock and you're using cyanide to separate things, you release all these other things that are in the rock. And in about half of the mines around the world, there's sulfides. And when they get exposed to air and water, they turn into sulfuric acid and they leach other things, iron into the water. Pennsylvania rivers are yellow, orange, from iron that came from the coal mining. So it is one of the most environmentally dangerous professions, and mining and water do not mix.
And now your story picks up in 2009. As the government of El Salvador is faced with an ultimatum, either allow this Canadian company, mining company, Pacific Rim, to mine for gold, or pay them over $300 million in costs and foregone profits from future mining? I mean, that seems completely bizarre. What gave Pac Rim the right to make these demands?
Well, Francesca, I'm not surprised, but I am, of course, relieved that you, among others, find it totally bizarre. So you and your listeners won't be surprised to learn that the global economic rules and regulations are set up in such a way so that the power and the voice of the global elite, especially the global corporations, are given priority over the voice of national governments and local communities. More than 50 years ago, the World Bank set up a venue in its group called ICSID, the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. That arbitration panel, a de facto court, hears cases that corporations bring against governments. A global corporation brings it against a different government than where it is headquartered to argue that that government has done something not only to keep the corporation out, but to deprive it of, and here's the amazing phrase, future profits foregone. All of Latin America, the majority of countries from what we now call the third world, voted against the setting up of this court, this arbitration panel. But alas, and not surprisingly, it was set up anyways. So governments cannot sue corporations in this venue, communities cannot sue corporations, but corporations in this case, a Canadian corporation called Pacific Rim, now owned by an Australian company called Oceana Gold, sued the government of El Salvador because the government of El Salvador had not approved its projected mining venture based on environmental concerns. John already explained those environmental concerns. PacRim did not have a mining license, did not have a concession, so it should have not been able to sue, but it sued anyways in this, in ICSID, in this venue where corporations almost always win.
Is this the same venue that sued, I don't remember which company, for trying to control tobacco use? Is that correct?
Oh, you've got it. So that's one of the few other cases where the corporation didn't win. It was Philip Morris who sued Uruguay because Uruguay insisted that insisted on certain labeling and reduction of how many companies could sell cigarettes in Uruguay based on health concerns.
Wow, that's so incredible. Now, you guys came to this David and Goliath fight more than 5 years after its beginning. And you came to it as El Salvador's water defenders, and we're going to get into talking about who they were. Were due to receive an international award that you both were involved in giving. And it happened after one of their leaders, Marcelo Rivera, had been murdered. Who was he, and how was he connected to this struggle?
Sure. Well, we first heard of Marcelo because my institute, the Institute for Policy Studies, its Human Rights Award Selection Committee picked this group of organizations in northern El Salvador that were fighting mining. And every year we then bring people from the groups we're awarding to Washington. The Salvadorans, we could tell something special from the start. Normally we bring two people. They said they wanted to bring five. And one of them was a cultural worker named Marcelo Rivera. So we began to prepare for them to come. And then a month after we told them they were winning the award, they contacted us with the shocking news that Marcelo had been assassinated. Complete shock to us. And so that began for Robin and me and for the Institute for Policy Studies, a 10-year campaign to learn more about Marcelo and to help his brother, who in the end came in his place to among the five to accept the award. But Marcelo, you asked who he was. He was a teacher. He was a cultural worker. He cared deeply about his community. And since water is so scarce in El Salvador, he got involved in fights to fight a big landfill, to fight that would pollute the river, a big hog farm that would pollute the river. And then when the mining companies started coming in, he was the guy who said, okay, let's figure out whether this is a danger. As they learned about all the dangers I started with, all of the problems between mining and water, he became a fantastic organizer in his little community, his town of San Isidro, against mining. And just a final word about him. I mean, many of your listeners have been to protests. They've seen activists. This guy used laughter as a way to organize and educate people. He launched a caravan of laughter where everyone wore a clown nose. He used theater to teach about the dangers of mining. He was an incredibly creative organizer.
We're going to get back to him and his work, but I want to point out one of the other water defenders who was there was a young woman named Vidalina. Tell us about her and about her demand that she made, which was, you know, when I read it in your book, I thought, wow, that's a pretty big ask.
So Vidalina was a colleague and a best friend of Marcelo Rivera. And Vidalina is one of the main characters in our book. And more importantly, she's one of the main global voices from El Salvador in this struggle. Vidalina, like these other these other water defenders is a very ordinary, and we use that word very carefully, a very ordinary peasant, small farmer in northern El Salvador, who does extraordinary things to help keep mining out of her community. When I think of Vidalina, I think of her as actually the superwoman. So she wakes up in the morning, she grinds her corn, makes tortillas, 40, 50 tortillas for her husband and son. And then she starts walking along this dusty road in order to get the minibus to go to her office. And somewhere on that road, it says if she takes off her ordinary costume and puts on Superwoman. So she totally transforms herself and her persona and becomes really well known, not just locally and in El Salvador, but globally. And it really began with that award ceremony that John talked about. She was one of the five people who came to the Institute for Policy Studies in October 2009, and she was selected by the others to be their spokesperson. And so when she gave this speech, and I've got to tell you, I have goosebumps whenever I talk about Marcelo or this night in October 2009, and I'm getting them all over my body now. But so she's this petite woman. She's standing up there. I was a little nervous before she started speaking because I thought she was overwhelmed. I feared she would be overwhelmed by the hundreds of people in the audience. And the fact that she didn't speak English and it was going to be translated. And then she opened her mouth. And she didn't even need a microphone. She told the story. She told the story about Marcelo's murder. She told the story about the lawsuit. And she talked about the upside down world where corporations and global elites have much more power than local communities to define what happens in local communities. And she asked the audience to follow this, not only to help figure out why Marcelo and other water defenders were being murdered, but also to help in the fight that was happening just a few blocks away at that World Bank Court, to help make sure that the voices of the water defenders were heard over the voices of corporations. And as we say in the book, John and I were both hooked. We knew at that moment that we had to be a part of this. We did not know that it would be more than a decade, if not a lifetime, but we knew that whatever the chances of winning, that we were hooked.
Yeah, and now tell us a little bit more about this community of Marcelo and his brother Miguel, as well as of Vidalina. And is there anything special about this community that enabled them to pull together? Because it wasn't just this little group of organizers. It was the whole community that got involved.
Yeah, I'd say two things were very special about these people. One, they're farmers. And so anybody who's worked with farmers know how much farmers love their land and protect it and the water that helps them grow their crops. In northern El Salvador, they're mainly corn and bean farmers. Corn is central to the culture of this area all the way up through Mexico. So that's one thing. A second thing just to say, many Americans know El Salvador because there was a giant civil war there in the 1980s. The U.S. backed a horrible death squad government. 75,000 people were killed, but tens of thousands of people were organized in this part of El Salvador to fight against a death squad government. And eventually there were peace accords in 1992. So these are areas that have been organized to fight against oppression. Many of the water defenders we met were part of that fight or children who were part of that fight. So there is a history of resistance in these areas. And when the mining companies first came in and said, "We want a mine, we're here for the mines," we start with this very funny story of one person saying to these white men in suits, "Look, the UN already came here and cleared out all the mines. These were landmines left from the Civil War." And the white men in suits said, "No, we're here for a different kind of of mines, the mines that have gold and silver and so on in them. And that started the whole fight. So just to know that, you know, determined farmers wanting to preserve their land and some history of organizing people very creatively. And here we are, I'll just end with this. We're talking on a radio show with you, Francesca. They use community radio brilliantly. They did plays about the importance of water and threats to water on local radio, and they spread the word of the dangers of mining. Because keep in mind, when a mining company comes in, it promises jobs, it promises prosperity. It is very hard to resist that. And it was only after these folks did a huge amount of research, they went to neighboring Honduras, they went to eastern El Salvador where there were mines, only then did they realize that this would destroy their livelihoods. And then they began one of the most creative education campaigns that Robin and I have ever seen.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with John Cavena and Robin Broad about their book, The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed. Yeah, so talk about that. In doing that, they networked. In fact, they created a monthly roundtable called La Mesa. Tell us about that roundtable. You know, they developed a kind of coalition, and tell us what role it played in their ultimate success.
Well, another great question, Francesca, and this is really important to grasp in terms of one of the many lessons from the struggle about why it was successful. So, again, it began as a grassroots social movement. It began with the people who would be most affected by the mine, but it began with Marcelo, Miguel, Vidalina, and not all of their community, but the majority of their community. But at a certain point, they realized that that wasn't enough. That while Marcelo was being incredibly successful in his province, in his state, leading the organization, organizing against the mining, that they had to go national. So they began reaching out to people in different provinces, some of whom the older water defenders knew because of that civil war, and others of whom were young environmentalists with their own organizations, were journalists, were human rights workers. And they convened in the capital city in San Salvador discussions to figure out what they could do beyond this very local resistance. And out of that came a coalition, a formal coalition called the Roundtable Against Mining, or La Mesa. And they met at least every month, but they were constantly in work. And it was an issue mainly for the areas of northern El Salvador in terms of the mining companies coming in. That's where the rich vein of gold goes from Guatemala through El Salvador into Honduras. But it was also an issue for the rest of El Salvador because the majority of people in El Salvador depend on this one main river, the Lempa River, for their water. So whether you were in a mining area or you were in an area where you needed that water to bathe, to drink, for your farm or for your industry, you had to care about mining. And then beyond that local and national coalition, they also, beginning with this event at the Institute for Policy Studies where Vidalina spoke, they also reached out globally. And we can talk about that more, but we were involved in, John and I and others were involved in, at their request, setting up a global coalition called International Allies of La Mesa to work on the global part of this fight, and that is the World Bank and the transnational corporation. So it was a very sophisticated yet logical three tiers of coalitions, but with the core being the grassroots social movement, which I think is so important to stress, that they were the ones who really led the fight and led the demands.
Yes, and that may be really the key, as you say, the key to their success. They also reached out to some pretty unlikely allies, actually, you know, a right-wing archbishop and a politician. Talk about that and tell us, you know, what lessons can be learned from that success?
Sure. You know, that was one of the most intriguing pieces of this fight, and a piece that we, Robin and I, and our allies at the Institute for Policy Studies and our other allies kept asking ourselves, would we have been as bold as they were? Here's what they looked at. Once they got to the national level, and once they decided, you know, in many fights in this country and elsewhere against big corporations, Amazon or Walmart is coming into your community, you fight to get them out. In El Salvador, as Robin was alluding to, La Mesa pretty quickly decided, okay, our goal is big, it's audacious. We want to ban all mining in this country. We don't have enough water. And we want to become the first country in the world to ban mining to save our rivers. Once you're at that level, you've upped the stakes. And they looked at their national legislature. They realized it's 2/3 conservative parties. We're not going to win this. And we aren't even sure we have our left-wing party, because the left-wing party was being influenced by socialist governments in other parts of Latin America and Bolivia and Ecuador that were mining. So they look at this and say, how in the world do we translate this desperate need to end mining with the political realities? And they said, okay, we got to win over some people who don't agree with us on most other issues. Now, water turned out to be a good issue to do that with, but in a country that is heavily Catholic, their first big, bold move in this direction was to try to win over the Archbishop. The Archbishop at this point, this is the successor to the saint, Oscar Romero, who was killed in the Civil War, was a guy who was conservative. I mean, more than conservative. He belonged to this, some think of it as a right-wing cult in the Catholic Church, Opus Dei. Most of the people in La Mesa said, don't go near that guy. He's part of Opus Dei. They said, we got to go. We got to try bold things. They try to meet with him. He's blowing them off. They finally get a meeting. They go in. They explain the situation. He's not paying any attention to them. Then they mention cyanide. You need cyanide to separate the gold from the rock. His whole face lights up. He says, why didn't you say this earlier? I have a degree in chemistry. I know that cyanide is toxic. We can't have it here. And that turns around the Catholic Church, which becomes key in now making the education national, as La Mesa then helps inform people in the church about the dangers of mining. And it is then spread through the pulpits across the country. They did this several times. They did it against internal opposition, because these were, it would be like saying to you, Francesca, we want you to reach out to Mitch McConnell here in order to win this thing. And you say, what? No way. I mean, because just the other one that jumps out at the end of the fight. So the big, you know, bad party in that civil war is called ARENA. They reached out, educated, won over a key ARENA congressperson on the environment committee. And he became an ally of the fight to save the water of El Salvador.
It's such an incredible and inspiring part of the story. I'm going to ID you now, even though we're pre-taping it. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Robin Broad and John Cavanna about the Water Defenders, how ordinary people saved a country from corporate greed. Now, you guys also got access to the emails of corporate mining executives and their lawyers. How did that happen, and what did you find out?
Well, Francesca, we were hoping that you would ask that question, because that is a key thing to add, since so much of what we've talked about so far is our working with and gaining trust of the Water Defenders and how extraordinary they were as ordinary people. But we couldn't have written. So one thing was the work we did with the Water Defenders, but the second thing, or then the other, another thing was deciding to write this book. But we couldn't have written this book unless we had access to other voices. Your radio show is called Writers' Voices. So we were using our voice to channel the water defender's voice, but the book wouldn't ring true. It wouldn't tell the whole story unless we had the voices of those corporate executives. The problem was they wouldn't meet with us. Although they told us, although they, their PR was that they would meet with anyone, they would give anyone tours of their operating mines in other countries. And we actually went to the Philippines to research one of their working minds. They refused to talk to us and they refused to let us in. But like many parts of this story, which were either serendipity or fight, or like many parts of this story, which were either serendipity or fate, because of that lawsuit at the World Bank Group, we had legal access, we acquired legal access to troves of their documents that they had to turn over to the lawyers and to the World Bank. So we had internal emails, we had internal reports, we had letters they had written to the Minister of Economy in El Salvador. And we also, through other legal means, got a box of documents from Pacific Rim, Oceana Gold, and other mining companies. And that was an amazing gift, if you will, because we could follow their tactics and their strategy even more carefully and even more honestly than we could have ever if they had interviewed with us. And also they couldn't complain because the words were there on papers. And so paper, what you see is very good geologists and hydrologists and engineers discovering the gold. That's what they did. That's what their job was. But then being totally baffled by when confronted with a community who did not agree with the mining corporation's definition of progress. And the mining company could not imagine, to quote the CEO, could not imagine how, and now I'm somewhat paraphrasing that quote, how ordinary rice and bean farmers could possibly be against mining. And she said, there have to be rogue NGOs who are influencing these people because of course they would want mining.
And that just underscores your point that when you root a struggle at the grassroots, then you have real power and legitimacy. Now, let's go to the decision. And they won in court, a unanimous vote. Tell us, how did that happen?
Sure. Well, we lay out in the book three mysteries. Who killed Marcelo? Could El Salvador possibly win in this court? And three, could El Salvador become the first country to ban mining? The first big date, we're in 2016, they're 12 years into this fight, they're 7 years into the legal battle. Finally, we hear that this tribunal with three tribunalists is going to rule on the court case. Keep in mind, the mining company is asking for over $300 million from a poor country and foregone profits. And amazingly, because corporations either win or they settle out of court and get a bunch of money in two-thirds of these cases. Amazingly, unanimously, the three tribunalists rule against the mining company. And they order it to pay $8 million, you know, about half of the legal fees of El Salvador in this case. And as we step back and look at it, yes, we did find out that all of the work that International Allies did, all of the letters, all of the petitions, we got over 280 groups representing 180 million people to send petitions to the tribunalists and also to the corporation. All of that pressure helped, but also individuals play a role. El Salvador hired a brilliant lawyer who we ended up meeting, befriending, and coordinating with, a man named Luis Parada. And he had a brilliant legal strategy. And at the end of the day, he convinced the tribunal that they had not gotten, the mining company had not gotten legal access to the land under which they wanted to mine. That was at the core of what they messed up. I mean, again, it wasn't because of the rivers, it wasn't because of the pollution, it wasn't because of the communities. These cases are a set of very narrow legal things in the end, and they won the case. So hooray, massive celebration, but that then leads La Mesa and all of us into, okay, can you turn that victory into the final victory, which is won in the Salvadoran legislature? Could they become the first country to ban mining to save their rivers?
If I could just add one quick point. For people who are part of International Allies or La Mesa who may be listening, we are very careful to try not to say that El Salvador won, because El Salvador spent 7 years and over $13 million and all that wasted time fighting the mining company. So rather, the mining company lost. Because once a case is brought against a country in this World Bank court, the country doesn't win. I mean, if the country is lucky, then the corporation loses.
Yes, that's a very important point. And thank you for making it. Now, El Salvador did pass a total ban on metals mining, and other countries are moving in the similar direction. Of course, we don't know if that ban will be overturned in another administration. But other countries are moving there, like Argentina, Colombia, Costa Rica, Panama, and others. So what's going on with those countries?
You know, for many years, Francesca, the debate in Latin America was not about whether you mined or didn't mine. It was about how much could you get from the mining companies when you mined. We're now in an amazing moment in the world where environmental issues are front and center, partly because of climate change, partly because of water and the connection between climate change and water. So one of the most exciting things that Robin and I got into, and we get into it in the epilogue of the book, is that these anti-mining struggles to save water, water is life, are spreading all over. And as you've mentioned a bunch of the countries right now, I would say for listeners, watch Chile. Chile is in a constitutional convention. It's having a big national election this year. The concerns about the environmental costs of mining have pressed all the major presidential candidates to come out against a big mine that is being built near an ecologically sensitive area. Ecuador just had a presidential election. An indigenous leader totally opposed to mining, got 20% of the vote. So this is a new debate in Latin America and around the world as people wake up to the fact that you can't mine safely. We need to stop a lot of the mining going on in the world. And I'll just say for consumers here in the United States, we all consume a massive amount of metals and the products we buy. It is creating a big debate about the need to completely rethink our use of metals, the need to recycle most of the metals we use. So this little story about El Salvador, it turns out, is about a global debate that will be central to the preservation of the planet over the next generation.
And of course, that debate is also happening right here in the United States. They call themselves water protectors, but against pipelines, against other mega projects, it's the same slogan that water is life.
So, yeah, and we only have like 3 minutes left, if that. So I just want to quickly ask you, you know, metals mining is actually key to transitioning the world to clean energy. So we have to fight climate change, but you're saying that if there's mining that's going on, first of all, can it be done safely? And second of all, we have to really get into the recycling of metals. Is that right?
One of the things, Francesca, that climate activists are figuring out now, which is very tricky, is that in the massive shift we're about to go through towards electric cars, towards a clean energy economy, One of the minerals that's central to a battery in an electric car is lithium. Like gold, it is extreme. No, you can't mine it sustainably. And therefore, a huge challenge will be, how do we do this transition and yet not greatly expand car use in this country? In other words, we don't need people to go from two gas-guzzling vehicles to two electric vehicles. We need them to shift to one electric vehicle, or in many families, to public transit. And that is a reality check on all of this. We need, at least half of the mining in the world needs to end to preserve communities and water around the world, but it can be done if we are serious about shifting the whole incentive structure massively towards recycling.
Yes, that's a great place to stop. We still have the question of who killed Marcello, but we will leave that up to our listeners to buy your wonderful book. Really a terrific story, well told. The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed. Robin Broad and John Cavanna, thank you so much for talking with us here. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.